And we're back for another episode in the Channel 9 studio. Very exciting to be in the Channel 9 studio here at Microsoft headquarters. We're here coming to you live. I'm here for the Tech Mentor event that's going on this week. And I've been lucky enough to catch once again for another episode of Interview with an MVP, Mr. Kelly Murphy, CTO, co-founder, food aficionado. See, I knew I'd catch him laughing. Co-founder of GridStore. And so he's what we would call a data center and virtualization storage expert. And so he's got some really cool things that we're going to talk about today. Specifically, we wanted to have a little conversation about storage quality of service and kind of the importance in your data center today about being able to deliver kind of that precise I/O down to an individual VM. So I guess the very first question that I have for you, Kelly, is a lot of our viewers that are out there, and they've been writing in and just kind of asking some questions and letting us know what, you know, kind of the things that they'd like to see in some of the episodes. And there was a really good question that came in from one of our viewers that was in relations to IHOPs. So can you tell us what an IHOP is?
I told you. Restaurant, Dave.
Sorry. I told you I'd make him laugh. No, we're not talking about IHOP the restaurant. We're talking about IOP.
So, IOPs.
All right, IOPs. So can you set the record straight for us on an IOP? What is an IOP? Not an IHOP.
As opposed to an IHOP?
IHOP is where you get pancakes.
Pancake house, yeah.
And remember, there's only one take in these episodes. So just so you know, everything that you view is live. We don't do retakes.
No editing.
There's no editing. We don't have time for that.
So an IOP, I can't keep a straight face. an IOP is an I/O instruction.
All right.
To storage.
Okay.
So a write a block or read a block of I/O from storage.
Okay.
Usually it's a defined size. So like say 8K, write an 8K block of I/O. That's one IOP.
All right.
Okay. So IOPs, some of the confusion comes from, they vary in size. Okay, I could write 32K IOPs, or I could write 64K IOP, or a megabyte.
Is it fair to say that, you know, a lot of the people that are out there in the industry today, they're using this as a tool to quantify or measure the speed of the storage solutions that they're selling? Like I've seen it quite a bit actually advertise that. Oh, my storage array will give me, you know, 20,000 IO, or 50, or 100, or a million, or whatever it is. And so is that something that's actually real that people can quantify?
It is a quantified measure, but again, what you have to look at is the detail behind that. What is the IO? Is it, you know, a 512 byte, or is it 1 megabyte? They're two very different things. So they're two different measurements. So if somebody is saying I do a million IOPS, you know, the question really is how big is that IO? Okay. And you know, the second and probably most important question is what's the latency of these IOs?
Yes.
How long does it take to actually execute that IO? So that's the measure of the performance, is how many of these IOs can I get through? And how long does it actually take?
Well, and the latency is actually something that's very, very important for applications that are running inside of our data center.
Right.
I used to do a lot of work with Microsoft Exchange before kind of everything kind of went cloud-centric with Office 365. And when we were building Exchange farms, we would run a stress testing tool on the farms before we would go live to make sure that we weren't going to have, you know, storage issues.
Yeah.
And so I think the utility was called JetStress. It's been a few years. Yeah. I haven't really done a heck of a lot of work with Exchange in a few years. But JetStress would build us a measured report. So we could run it on local direct attached disk. We could run it on Fibre Channel. We could run it on iSCSI. It didn't really matter what the platform was. The one thing, though, that we were always looking for inside of those reports was the latency. So you bringing that up is actually a really good point, because in order for us to what we'll call certify one of those Exchange farms and the builds that we would do, we had to be sub 20 milliseconds.
Yeah, that was a typical measurement of that time.
Yep.
It was sub 20 milliseconds. That's, you know, adequate, you know, performance that's not going to be perceived to be slow?
What you can think of, because like I said, a lot of people have the questions today about the IOPS and the measurement and how fast these things are. That latency is actually a very good discussion to have as well. And so that concept of, you know, a good standard being sub 20 millisecond latency was coming from our world that we lived in, which was spinning disks.
Right.
So we would combine spinning disks together, we would aggregate them together in a volume or a logical unit called a LUN, and the more disks that we threw at that particular, you know, that volume or that LUN, typically the more I/O we'd be able to generate, but the latency was always going to be a bit of an issue.
Right.
So I think an important concept is, as we're moving to the concept of an all-flash data center, what's the typical latency that we see now? Is it less than 10?
Oh yeah.
Is it less than one?
You're typically, most systems you'd see now will be probably around 1 millisecond.
1 millisecond.
And
so
it can be sub-millisecond depending on where the storage, the flash, is actually sitting.
Wow. So would you consider, with the new technologies coming out, that we might have to consider stop using the term millisecond, and we might be into, like, I don't even know what the measure is. Is it called a microsecond? So I think the new measurements that we're going to be looking at for this new all-flash data center, we could be. It depends on,
you know,
the geometry of the disks and things like that.
Put it this way. That's a, you know, from what we had before to, you know, as best system, okay? And that, you know, to get 20 milliseconds of latency required a lot of disks, okay? Now you can get, you know, 1 millisecond, you know, 20 times that performance off of one drive, one SSD.
That's incredible, and that's we're just what I consider to be moving into, I would say, like a generation two of solid state technology that's kind of coming out. Your Gen 1 technology was kind of giving that. The new generation is going to be even faster. The next generation beyond that, the disks are even going to be growing. So, I had another really good question from one of the viewers, which was, what are you seeing for the trends in the data center in regards to the size of disks? Because this is one of the things,
flash drives.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we're starting to see an all-flash data center is the drive sizes are increasing, correct?
Yeah.
Now, the specific question that came in was, the increase in drive size, does it impact my performance? So if I go from a 1 terabyte to a 2 or 4 or what will soon be 8 and 16 terabyte drives, am I going to actually see a performance decrease with going larger capacity?
We haven't seen that yet.
Really?
I can't say, you know, going forward that's going to continue to be the case, but so far what, you know, we started with were just under 1 terabyte drives.
Yep.
We moved and doubled that and then doubled that again. Okay, and we're seeing the same level of performance, okay, with a 4x factor of capacity behind them now.
So what you're saying is that if we had a 4 terabyte drive now, which we were actually just talking about over coffee, it's amazing. Your company's actually started to skew those up now. You're going to be shipping 4 terabyte drives.
Yes, we do.
Wow. So think about that in your data center today. That, you know, that could be a real game changer in itself, just the size of those drives.
And if you think about that in our hyper-converged packaging, so you've got a 2U unit. It's
got four
nodes in it.
Yeah.
Four discrete nodes.
Why don't we show people that, here?
Sure.
All right.
So this is the building block, and in that block, it's a 2U unit. There's actually 4 individual nodes and 24 drives.
Okay,
so what you actually have inside of that are 96 cores, okay,
and
92 terabytes of flash.
Whoa, 92 terabytes of flash?
Yes.
Now, that's not all usable space, right? Like there is...
Correct, that's raw.
Yep.
Okay, so there's roughly, I think it's about 60 terabytes of that would be usable. So roughly 66%.
So 60 terabytes of what we would consider like tier zero storage space where you could put your highest performing requirement VMs.
Yeah.
Wow. That is incredible.
And the other thing that's happened is that the longevity of that. So, you know, first generation flash devices, people had to really worry about the wear rates on the devices. Okay. because of the cell technology in them. What there's two things that have been happening, and it's a little bit like Moore's law, where you know processors doubled in terms of capacity and transistors every couple years and so on, while staying at the same cost. We're seeing maybe not quite the same kind of trend, but a similar type of a trend with flash, which is the density is growing, okay, significantly. So we've seen a 4x increase within 2 years.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I saw some articles actually that a lot of the manufacturers are actually looking at 8 and 16 terabyte drives. And you guys work actually very closely with a lot of the solid state manufacturers with your technology, right?
Yeah.
So you kind of have that
leading edge of
inside
really
track.
Using this. But you know, these are high production, high volume drives now. These aren't experiments or anything. But as I said, there's two things. The first was the density has really increased. The second is the longevity. Okay, so that same drive, let's say we use the smaller drives, the 1 terabyte drive, so that would have 23 terabytes of flash in it, that unit there. I can write 3.6 full drive writes per day, okay, to each of those drives. So 23 terabytes multiplied by 3.6. I can write that every day. That's whatever, 75 terabytes.
75 terabytes.
95 or something.
No, we'll have the right numbers. You got to do this math on the fly, whatever. It's a lot.
It's 92 terabytes.
Kay.
Okay. 92 terabytes a day, okay, for 5 years.
Wow.
So over a 5-year period, I can write 150 petabytes of writes, okay, onto what was 23 terabytes. Now, nobody has ever bought a storage system and filled it up 3.5 times the next day.
Normally we just fill them and they just sit there because they're full and we can never get our data off of them.
Yeah, but you know, it happens gradually over time, right?
Yeah.
You don't buy a storage system and fill it up 3 times the next day or 3.5 times the next day. It just doesn't happen.
Yeah.
So the longevity of these drives have got to a point where, you know, wear on flash is not an issue anymore.
It almost becomes an infinite use case because you'll never really be able to push them hard enough to wear them out.
And the other thing is the durability, right, is that there are no spinning parts. There's no moving parts in this anymore. So their reliability is, the data is starting to really show this, is much better than spinning disk.
Yeah. Well, and you guys would know because I don't think your return department takes back very many flash drives at GridStore.
No, and that's the thing, right? We have not seen failures. You know, we did ship spinning disks before, and we've obviously seen failures. So I don't have the exact numbers, but I know that the numbers are significantly higher now.
Oh,
and they're getting better all the time.
It's incredible, and that's such a good conversation to have, just because that's one of the real ways that the data centers are transforming, is that we're not confined and constrained with, you know, that size of drive and kind of that geometry.
Right.
All right, so you know, this episode, one of the things that we wanted to go through was, now that we've kind of got this all-flash data center as a reality and kind of a possibility, being able to deliver quality of service specifically in relation to storage on kind of a per workload basis becomes really key.
Yeah.
Because now I just unlock the power of that SQL server. And you know, for the whole array that it lived on before, it might have only had 2,000 or 3,000 I/O. Now it could have 200,000 or 300,000 I/O.
Correct.
And so you can't just leave your hyperconverged infrastructure as the Wild West for all the VMs to just fight with one another.
Yeah.
We want to be able to precisely dial that in. So how what have you seen in the industry, and kind of what's your company GridStore done to address that issue?
Yeah. So you know, one of the keys is in the infrastructure. The way it works is that, you know, we use that unit, that block. It's got the 4 nodes in it. You start with that, okay? Then you can grow it incrementally. So I in that first block, maybe there's 3 nodes, okay? That's our minimum that you can start with is 3. I can then add the 4th, okay? In those 3 nodes, you're going to see roughly about a 50,000 IOPS per node. Okay, so 150,000 in the first 3.
So if I do the math, 1, 2, 3, 4 nodes, 200,000 I/O in a 2U kind of footprint?
To be precise, that would be 8K IOs, okay? You know, random IOs, 70-30 roughly split between reads and writes.
Because remember, it's important that you qualify those answers whenever you're talking about your I/O.
That's what you would typically see coming out of, say, databases.
Yes.
Okay, small I/Os like that, and in that kind of a mix. So for every one of those nodes that we add, we're adding then roughly another 50,000 IOPS.
Absolutely.
So I can start with something that's small, and then I can grow this infrastructure, and I end up with a pool of compute and a pool of, you know, high-powered storage. Now, that can be a lot of IOPS, right? Do I want all of that to get sucked up by one, you know, heavy workload? Probably not.
For sure.
So I need a way to control.
Do you have an illustration that we can maybe show what this would look like? We can come back to that one.
Yeah.
Here, let's flip over to that.
There we go.
We're still learning the Channel 9 studio, so.
So in this model now, what you have is you see the infrastructure at the bottom, right? So your pool of compute and a pool of storage, and riding on top of that are your VMs.
Okay? Yes.
And a key part of our hyperconverged solution is being able to isolate the I/O that comes from each of these virtual machines. So we do that effectively by creating these channels on a per VM basis.
Okay.
That comes back to our architecture, which is we actually control both ends of this protocol. It's purpose-built for this reason, okay? But when I'm sitting on both ends, that means I can control the flow on a per VM basis. I literally create a set of channels, which is a set of socket pairs, so I can isolate the I/O across these channels. That allows me to deliver X amount of IOPS, okay, in whatever measurement I want. If I want to give 25,000 IOPS to VM1, that's my SQL server that's running, I can now set a reserve so it gets a minimum of 25,000 IOPS. Okay. Equally, I can make sure that others are not getting, you know, more than 500 IOPS, as an example. So now I have the ability to easily kind of fine-tune what resource is actually being consumed. I don't want that SQL server to get 50,000 IOPS, okay? 25,000 is more than enough. And I don't want it to suck up all 200,000 IOPS because there's nothing left for the rest of the workloads. So I got the ability now to kind of precisely fine-tune how I want to allocate this.
So this would be incredibly valuable for hosting companies or for companies that are running larger farms.
Yes.
For the smaller farms, you're probably never really going to push the solid state to the point that it's going to really become a problem, but the options are still there.
There's two cases where this still makes sense. Is in every business, small or large, you know, there's 20% of the workloads are really important, okay? I want to make sure that they get what they need. And I want to make sure that something else that's not important doesn't impact them, okay?
Things go wrong. That's a good way to look at it, yeah.
Things go wrong, okay? And this little rogue application that, you know, some developer just spun up crashes or kills the storage system because it just sucks the life out of it. That happens, okay? Now I have a way to isolate that and make sure that it doesn't exceed a certain level. And I'm going to guarantee this high priority workload, you know, what it actually needs. So even in a small business, that makes sense. In a large enterprise, you've got more stuff moving, okay, but you probably still have the same 80-20 ratio. If you're a service provider, you literally have different classes of service. I'm going to sell you a VM that has, you know, X number of cores in it, X amount of RAM in it, X amount of IOPS attached to that.
Oh, and that's very attractive because then you can actually make sure that, you know, you're never going to oversubscribe, you know, what's available inside of the units when you're taking or selling them.
And for the guys that came in on the entry level package, okay, they're only going to get this. And I want to make sure they only do get that. But if I want to bump you up on the weekend or you have a workload you want to run on a special project and you're going to happily pay extra for that, I can now dial you up to the next level. So having the ability to control and do this at a policy level or, you know, kind of sets of groups, or, you know, I can set these levels, or if I want to, I can go into one specifically and say, okay, turn the dial on that.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. Now, as we're kind of driving the conversation into, you know, the hosting providers, there's a lot of organizations that have bought into the Microsoft Azure platform.
Yeah.
And with that Azure platform, you can actually build Azure in your own data center. And you can do that by using something called Windows Azure Pack. And so the question that I have for you, Kelly, is your system, can you use your system with the back-end components that drive Windows Azure Pack, which is System Center?
Yeah, so we're packaging I have options available for customers. So you think about the infrastructure, the hardware layer. On that is running Windows Server Hyper-V.
Yep.
Okay, you have options then to add System Center to that and Azure Pack. So effectively, you can create a private or a hybrid cloud infrastructure, you know, on-prem that can be, you know, look for all intents and purposes like Azure, okay, operate that. It could be self-service for people and so on. And you can also use things like ASR, Azure Site Recovery, to literally create that hybrid cloud and have VMs controlled all now through a single pane of glass, right from on-prem all the way up through into Azure for DR purposes.
Well, and that's very, very important. And moving back to kind of our topic in the episode, as you start building kind of that hosting platform, the importance of being able to really precisely dial in your IO on a per VM or per customer, per tenant basis is pretty huge.
Yeah.
All right, well, I'm looking at the time here. I think that's probably all the time that we have for this particular episode that we have. Kelly, once again, thank you for your time. It's always a pleasure sitting down. And I think we may actually have time for one more. The girls aren't kicking us out of the studio just yet. So it's been awesome having everyone, and stay tuned for the next episode.
Excellent.